that with me. Did you all both sign in?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Great. And Mr. McCracken, any time you're ready to begin on Ms. Phillips' matter, would you care to reserve any time for
rebuttal? Let me try for five, Judge. We sometimes know that's not going to happen, but we'll give it a shot. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Barry McCracken. I'm here on behalf of Tiffany Phillips. She was convicted in the Norfolk Circuit Court of felony embezzlement, and there are two assignments there. The first deals with the issue of value, and the second deals with the issue of value, but for a different purpose, whether or not the Commonwealth satisfied its burden established that she should be ordered to pay restitution amount of $3,502. The facts here are relatively straightforward. She's a cashier at a convenience store. Basically, a customer comes in. She issues seven money orders, a total value of $3,502 face value, does not receive payment for the money orders. The customer's given the money orders.
Mr. McCracken, is a money order a negotiable instrument?
It is, Your Honor.
Suppose, change the facts a little bit, and they stole savings bonds. Would your argument be the same?
A savings bond's in a different category. Certainly, if it's U.S. currency, basically U.S. currency is presumed to have the value on the face, and there's well-established case law about that. Savings bond, I would have to say, I haven't looked at it, but to the extent it's a choice in action, it probably is. It would not be different. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I didn't think about savings bonds. I thought about other negotiable instruments. The problem with a choice in action is you're not buying a commodity. You're buying a store of value. But it's subject to any negotiable instrument is subject to defenses. Basically, that the bank goes bankrupt. There's a stop payment order on the check or cashier's check. All of those, that's the problem with a choice of action. You're not getting an item other than obviously the stock that the check is printed on. What you're getting is an obligation to pay, but those obligations to pay, even on negotiable instruments, have recognized defenses. And in this particular case, the only thing the evidence established was that the money orders were typed out in $500 increments for seven of these and $2 increments for the other two. So that individual left with a negotiable instrument. We have to presume that they were, we don't know. There's no evidence as to whether or not they were correct in form or not. So I think the Commonwealth is entitled to presumption they were correctly filled out. In other words, they didn't have samples stamped on them or void or anything of that nature. But what she left with was a choice in action. Now, I mean, I think one of the concerns here, and I can address the 5A18 problem if you'd like, but I think I addressed it about as well as I could in the reply brief, and that's the position we take. Neither side actually used 18298 or referred to the common law, but the issues involved in that were clearly laid out to the trial judge in this discussion about value, both from the defense side and from the Commonwealth side. The defense says they haven't established value of these things, and the Commonwealth says we're entitled to an inference. Well, they're not entitled to an inference under the common law, and Section 18298, which provides that inference if this was a larceny prosecution, doesn't apply to prosecutions under 18.2.111 specifically says that you can embezzle a bank note and a money order. I mean, I don't think it lists money order, but clearly a money order is within the definition of what may be embezzled under 18.2.111. But interestingly, the legislature decided not to tell you what the value of these things would be. So there is no inference under the statute. The default position in dealing with these issues is the common law. If the legislature doesn't set out inferences, then you have to look at the common law. There is no common law. In fact, the common law is just the opposite. It doesn't provide an inference. In fact, the inference from common law is it's worth the stock it's printed on, and that's it. And that's really where we are today. And I would suggest to you that, first and foremost, defense counsel, although this thing went back and forth and they were arguing about a number of other things, but essentially the defense counsel's position was that Commonwealth was not entitled to an inference. You were dealing with an intangible. The trial judge posed a hypothetical dealing with the TV set going out of Walmart. And as he said, this is not a TV set. That's a tangible item. It's got set value. Under the common law, a money order is not. It's simply a store of value. It's subject to defenses. There are two cases, really there are only two cases that deal with this issue that I found. I can't pronounce one of them. Both of them are court appeals cases. Ubalaba, I believe, is the credit card case, and Hunt is the lottery ticket case. It's a winning lottery ticket. It's stolen, and under that prosecution, under 18295, the court ruled that the value of the ticket is simply the value of the money, the stock it was printed on, not the value of the ticket.
The lottery ticket has no value other than if you hit the right number.
Well, that one in Hunt, they had. That was it. That was a stolen lottery ticket that was a winning ticket. In other words, that they had already announced I don't know whether it was announced or whether it was a scratch off where you scratched, and it was a winning ticket. It was, it was something that could be taken into the lottery office and a $2,500 payment would be received.
But isn't that the difference? You have to turn in a winning lottery ticket in exchange for the payment, whereas the money order immediately has value upon purchase?
Well, keep in mind, there was no purchase here. There was no purchase.
But for the purpose of the store, that doesn't really make any difference.
Well, we don't know that. For the store, they were able to issue a stop order immediately. So we don't know, and there's no evidence in the record.
Really just goes to whether they sustained an actual loss, not whether or not somebody embezzled.
Well, again, if you receive something that has defenses built into it, just because it's a negotiable instrument, it does not have the status of currency. It's something that if it's free of defenses, entitles the bearer, just like a lottery ticket, entitles the bearer to payment. It doesn't have intrinsic value. It's got a tight face value, but it's sort of like Confederate money. It might have $100. I remember back when I was growing up, Confederate bills were everywhere. You could wallpaper your house. They had no intrinsic value and no stored value.
You're that old that you go back to the Civil War.
Well, my grandmother remembered. I think it was Faulkner that said, in the South, the history's not forgotten. It's not even past. And I grew up in that part of the South during that era. I certainly did. But again, the Confederate money leaped to mind because basically it's a chosen action. It was, and one of the reasons for the common law was because basically before U.S. currency was circulated, there were all sorts of banknotes that floated around, and those banknotes were worthless quite often. Because they go on strength of, in this case, Western Union. But again, it's not cash. It doesn't get the same presumption as cash. It's a negotiable instrument. There's no disagreement here. But there's nothing in the common law that gives you an inference. The legislature saw fit when they were talking about larceny of these types of items to provide an inference of face value. But they didn't extend it to embezzlement prosecutions. And the legislature is presumed to know the law when they enact the various statutes. 18298 has been around for at least 100 years, if not longer, or some version of it. But they never attached that presumption to embezzlement cases. And according to Conway, had the burden to show that was really worth, in this case, all of them together, $3,502. They didn't put any evidence in on that. They didn't even show that the store was out of anything or didn't. Again, these are Western Union money orders. It's coastal. The name of the convenience store is Tiny China. But the corporation had various names, apparently. But in any event, there was no showing in the record of who even bore the loss on that. If they're either side, Western Union or Coastal, we don't know because it's not in the record. The money orders were property of Western Union. That is established.
You don't dispute the fact that the money order would come under the embezzlement statute?
Not at all. And we didn't challenge that. I don't want to get confused about this. We laid out all the basic elements in both briefs. But, the only issue here is, did they prove that the money orders are worth anything more than the stock? And that has some value. We don't even know what that is, but that'll get you misdemeanor. And our position is very straightforward. Without benefit of an inference, and there is none under the law, the Commonwealth had a burden to show that these were worth $500 or $3,502, and there's no evidence in the record to allow the court to make that finding. And accordingly, this should have been a misdemeanor conviction at best. And we'd ask that the court basically reverse and remand it back for trial on the misdemeanor if they're inclined to do that. Any questions?
Right on time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Forster.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephen Forster on behalf of the Commonwealth. Addressing counsel's arguments, it appears that he's conflating what the record says and what the arguments were at trial. Commonwealth doesn't contest that the issue of value was presented. The Commonwealth, under 518, is contesting the legal basis that was argued at trial and whether or not that was preserved. And a review of the record reveals that it wasn't preserved. Now, we look at this court's very familiar with Rule 5A18 and that it requires, and it's an obligation of counsel to put the precise issue before the court so it can rule intelligently on that issue. Now, trial counsel put forward two arguments. The first was that the Commonwealth couldn't prove embezzlement because they didn't establish that there was any personal benefit derived by the defendant. The trial court rejected that argument based on Wells versus Commonwealth, so you don't need a particular benefit derived by the defendant in order to convict on embezzlement. The second argument that counsel renewed his motion to strike on was there was no loss proven. The Commonwealth didn't prove that Tiny Giant or Western Union lost any money. And the entire colloquy that goes through the record over the discussion of the motion to strike has specifically to do with whether or not there was a particular loss. Not whether or not 18.298 applies, not whether the common law applies. There was nothing in the record discussed as to whether or not these money orders were only worth the medium on which they were printed. And it's repeated throughout the record. If we look at Joint Appendix 169, counsel argued, quote, no evidence anybody lost anything. And particularly of particular importance is that when the Commonwealth rephrased its argument, it said, quote, there was no loss, and in again, this is rephrasing defense counsel's argument, quote, there was no loss, and in connection with that loss, there was no evidence of any sort of value. Again, no objection to Commonwealth's rephrasing of the argument, no mention of a presumption or an inference, no argument as to the common law. It's just not there. And then as we scroll, and again, that was on Joint Appendix 171, again, we then look to the court's specific example that it gives counsel in trying to determine what it's specifically ruling on. And the court provides a very discreet example with the TV leaving the store. It says you go into Walmart, you put the TV in your cart, and you walk out. And the person is captured right outside of the door, and the TV is ultimately returned to the store. You can still have grand larceny and prove the value of the TV is more than $200, even though the property is returned. And again, the court is specifically addressing the loss. Not again, not the common law, not anything under these other case laws, not discussing lottery tickets, credit cards, but again, a very distinct issue. And again, the Commonwealth would argue that Rule 5A18, in a review of the record, makes very clear that the argument that is now before this court, addressing whether or not the money orders have the value of simply the medium they're printed on, wasn't preserved, and for that reason, it's not before the court. Or if the court's not persuaded by that, I'd like to briefly address the merits of the argument. Now, counsel has phrased the argument as sufficiency of the evidence. As this court is aware, it's whether or not any reasonable trier of fact could have found the elements of the offense. Now, when we look at the record, there is significant testimony as to what occurred, and I don't believe it's in dispute. The defendant was working at the convenience store. She issued 9 money orders, and there was testimony from 2 different individuals that there was 7 money orders at $500, 2 money orders at $1, creating a value of $3,502. Those money orders then walked out of the door. There was significant testimony, again, establishing value. And is to address some of the questions that the court posed to opposing counsel, that money orders are very different than a credit card. A money order, you pay cash for. It's a guaranteed surety. You pay the money, and you get the order and the printed value on it. It's not a lottery ticket. A lottery ticket doesn't have a value printed on it. A credit card does not have a value printed on it. For those reasons, those cases are distinguishable from this. Additionally, we look at the fact that embezzlement is a very distinct crime. It's a distinct statutory crime with different elements. It's not the same as a larceny case. It's not the same as the larceny of banknote statute. And while opposing counsel argues that that presumption, although it's not in the statute, that the Commonwealth should have just charged under larceny of banknotes, it's a different crime. There's different elements. They couldn't charge them under that statute. And again, I would suggest that the record has more than sufficient evidence to establish that the seven or the nine money orders had a value of $3,502, which is in excess of the $200 grand larceny requirement. And for that reason, the evidence was sufficient to sustain the conviction. Are there any questions from the court?
On the restitution issue, and I would ask the same question to Mr. McCracken, let's assume, at least for the sake of argument, that we agree with the Commonwealth on the issue of value. Face value of the money orders, and it's enough to support felony embezzlement. Restitution and actual loss, it looks like the Commonwealth concedes that there's no evidence of an actual loss that was sustained.
Yes, the Commonwealth concedes that issue.
So is that portion of the sentence to be vacated, or is it to be vacated and remanded to the trial court?
Vacate and remanded to the trial court for a determination on what the actual loss was.
And why not just vacate it based upon no evidence of an actual loss?
Again, the Commonwealth's position would be that if there was any value to the money orders, if there was any loss that was sustained as a result of them being voided or canceled.
But isn't it uncontested that there was a stop order so that nothing was ever paid on the money order?
Yes, Your Honor, there was...
Would there be any evidence on remand of any value other than maybe the value of the piece of paper, and they'd order restitution for a quarter?
I would agree, Your Honor, that it may be a minimal amount of restitution, but nonetheless, the Commonwealth would submit that it should be vacated and remanded for that determination.
Well, and I guess the question I would pose, and probably I expect Mr. McCracken will address this, was that... the actual sentencing hearing, was that the opportunity for the Commonwealth to present such evidence?
I believe that would have been the opportunity for the Commonwealth to present such evidence, Your Honor.
So why do they get a second bite of that apple if we find that there's not sufficient evidence to show that there's an actual loss?
I don't necessarily have a great answer as to why the Commonwealth should get a second bite of the apple.
We're looking not even for a great answer, but for a moderate answer.
I would submit...
In other words, I mean... In terms of judicial economy, what are we really gaining by remanding it back for another hearing?
I agree that the amount of value of the money orders would be very minuscule and negligible at best, and in the interest of judicial economy, I'm not certain what would be gained by having a restitution order in the amount of 25 cents. However, it was the position of the Commonwealth that if there was any loss, that it would be given that opportunity to the trial court to determine that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
No further questions. I will rest and rely on brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Always appreciate it.
Judge, point of clarification. Did I say 5 minutes or did I eat 15 minutes up?
No, you have 5 minutes left.
Wonderful. Basically, I'm somewhat discouraged, of course, by the lack of questions to the Commonwealth, but I'm accustomed to that as well. And let me note, I'm glad you brought it up. I had a big note here. You know, these days I have to write it and, stuff that you send to the federal courts, an 18-point font so I can read the stuff. Note, make certain you tell the court that on the restitution issue that basically the appropriate remedy is to dismiss that portion of the order. When in my prayer for relief in my brief, I basically set it out in the alternative. As I was thinking about this last night, I realized that was giving the Commonwealth a whole lot more than they're entitled to. They had an opportunity. That is the point, as the court properly pointed out, that the Commonwealth was called upon to put forth evidence of what restitution there was. This was not an evidentiary problem. This is not where the defendant objected to a piece of evidence going to the restitution, and the court erroneously allowed the evidence in. That may, if it was an evidentiary mistake, then I would agree the proper remedy would be remand. But I know nothing in the law that would suggest that once the Commonwealth is given the opportunity to put forth whatever amount of restitution ought to be paid out as a result of the judgment order, they get a second chance at the apple not based on an evidentiary defect, but simply on the basis of no evidence to establish the amount of restitution they were asking for. And I, you know, both for the reasons Judge Frank said of judicial economy. One, this thing shouldn't be banded back and forth. If we're not going to really get to taking it down to a misdemeanor and retrying this thing, then basically the order should be to set aside the restitution order and affirm the judgment. Now, I obviously don't think that's the right result, but if the court is not impressed with my argument on the first assignment of error or my argument as to 5A18, at least as the restitution issue, the remedy should be just dismissal at this point. Going back, I think I covered everything, and I think the court is very, very fully aware of what the two positions are. I disagree with the Commonwealth's position regarding whether or not trial defense counsel touched on the issues that are raised in the assignment of error, specifically in his final shot at the judge. Now, I noted, of course, the Commonwealth said we're entitled to an inference. We're entitled to an inference that these are worth $500 on their face. Where's that inference come from? The only inference I can find in the law is on the 18-298. That's why that issue is presented to the court. It was the Commonwealth's position. We're entitled for you to infer these are worth what their face says. Where does that inference arise from? It's not under the common law. It's not in the statute. And the only place in the code is 18-298, and that's not applicable to this particular prosecution. The defense did, in his colloquy with trial judge, talking about the Walmart hypothetical and the TV going out of the door, noted specifically, we're dealing with intangibles. That was you're talking about a grand larceny of a tangible object. This deals with intangibles, a corporeal item, a choice in action, as it were, and it doesn't have any inherent value. There is no presumption of value unless the legislation supplies it. They have not. And finally, as he was going out the door, as I pointed out in the reply brief, that the final argument by the defense counsel was, there's no evidence that the owner was deprived of anything except the paper on which the money orders were written. You can't infer that things that are absent from the record. And, you know, that's a direct statement. They're saying they're entitled to an inference. They're not entitled to an inference, and the only value that's been established is the value of the paper on which the money orders were printed. And I know y'all are the ones that like to throw the hypotheticals out and let me see if I can get them back over the net. Sometimes I do, and quite often I don't. But it occurred to me when we were looking at this, what if she just handed out blank money orders? You know, she rang them up as, according to one of the witnesses, she rang them up as a dollar money order. I mean, that the testimony is not completely consistent as to exactly what happened here as far as whether there was $7 paid for $3,502 money orders. That's just an inconsistency in the record, and that can be written off in any number of ways. But what if she'd simply handed over blank money orders? Would that be different? I don't think so. I mean, keep in mind, there's no purchase here. I mean, they're filling out of a dollar value on the Western Union money orders, and they're delivered. But there's no purchase, no payment, unless there were $7 paid. And that's not clear. I mean, the Commonwealth's position seems to be that she gave $3,502 worth of money orders for no payment. And the woman walked out the door. But what if it was just blank money orders? Would that change it? Shouldn't. I mean, if they got value, they have value. Well, what's the value of a blank money order? I mean, you could, you know, whatever.
Well, face. Is the difference there is it's not been printed with a face value?
Well, I generally money orders, and I don't judge. I don't know if it's in the record, but generally money orders have some limit. I mean, they're valid for so much, and that's printed. That's pre-printed on the form. We don't have those in the evidence, so I can't say that. But if what she did was simply rang up $7 and handed the woman 7 blank money orders. That could be cashed, let's assume, as $500 as the face max on the money orders. Would that be larceny of $3,502? I don't think so. And I don't think the fact she typed in the amount when that amount wasn't paid establishes any more value than the value of the money order in blank. And I mean, that's the problem with in the first case we talked about, Obalaba, was that it was a credit card, but they had a credit limit. And the theory of the Commonwealth in that case was the credit limit established the value of the credit card. You know, it's a $1,000 credit limit on a credit card. Therefore, when you stole a credit card, you stole $1,000 worth of value. And the court said that it doesn't work like that. That's not, and because it was, and that's, keep in mind, that's a larceny. All the cases we're talking about, both Hunt and Obalaba, are grand larceny cases. And so, you know, and we're dealing with embezzlement. But it's the same issue. And again, I do appreciate the court's attention, and I realize I've exhausted my time and probably your patience.
We're going to take that off your next case.
All right, sir. That's probably a good thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Consistent with the tradition of the court, we'll come down and greet.